You could say climate change has never been a hotter topic. I'm just going to let that sit there. Sorry, that was lame. But as a born and raised Calgarian, stewardship and conservation of our mountain environments is important to me. I've grown up hiking, skiing, and snowshoeing, and I'm not alone. I'm Blaise Kemna, and welcome to a special edition of the Canadian Mountain Podcast. It's a Monday evening, dark. The weather has begun to shift, the days are getting shorter, and the dim Glenbow Theatre has a cozy feel as guests file in. I've never seen a higher concentration of blunt stones and Arc'teryx Michelin Man jackets in one place, but I can't really talk because I basically dress the same. It's early November, and I'm at the Calgary Climate Symposium's event called Climate Change Impacts on Mountain Ecosystems and Communities. A panel of mountain researchers and guides who have contributed to the Alpine Club of Canada's State of the Mountains report are sharing their experiences. This episode is a unique, condensed version of the panel event, followed by a brief question and answer period. Over the next half hour, you'll learn about watermelon snow, find out what exactly a geomorphologist is, and hear about globetrotting adventures in search and study of all things ice and snow. So clip on your skis, do up your bindings, lace up your skates, whatever you want to call it, and enjoy. Let's go to moderator Meg Wilcox.
I'd like to introduce these very intelligent scientists and researchers who you'll be hearing from tonight. So first off, David Hick. He's a professor of biological sciences at Simon Fraser University. And David's research interests are focused on the ecology and dynamics of plants and animals in mountain and cold region environments. It was in 2017 that he co-created Mountains 101, which is a massive open online course, also known as a MOOC. And it's currently the number one ranked science MOOC in the world. Along with Zach Robinson and Lael Parrott, he co-edits the Alpine Club of Canada's State of the Mountains report. And next, we have Lael Parrott. She's a professor of Earth, Environmental, and Geographic Sciences and Biology at UBC Okanagan and vice president for Access and Environment at the Alpine Club of Canada. And she's an environmental geographer and develops new quantitative tools and computational models that consider the complexity of natural ecosystems and landscapes. She is especially intrigued by the wicked interdisciplinary problems where there are no obvious simple solution or resolutions that satisfy everyone involved. And she's also a co-editor of the State of the Mountains report. Lael, if you'd like to come up, thank you.
I imagine that most of you are here in this room for the same reason I am, and it's that we love mountains. And mountains are important not just for that and for the connection that we as Canadians feel with our mountain environments, but they're also important for other reasons. They provide us with fresh water, and they provide habitats for a wide variety of different species. As you all know, I'm sure, mountain environments are very fragile places, partly because of their short growing season, and also because they're harsh environments. And mountain environments are in continual change. And anyone who's spent any time in the mountains knows that. They're continually changing from geological to daily timescales, and at different scales of space as well. Change is always present in the mountains. But today, more than ever, our mountain environments are experiencing change, and that's as a result of the overarching driver of climate. None of our mountains can escape that driving force of climate change, and even our highest Canadian mountains are experiencing rates of warming that are between 3 to 6 times the global average at high elevations. Our lower elevation mountains are seeing hotter, drier summers, leading to more forest fires, leading to changing habitats for our species, leading to changing water temperatures and changing rates and timing of flow. And all of these changes are things that are discussed in the Alpine Club of Canada's State of the Mountains report, and that's what we're here to talk to you about today. So the State of the Mountains report is a publication of the Alpine Club of Canada. The Alpine Club of Canada is one of our coolest institutions. It was, and it's also one of the longest existing ones. It was formed in 1906 by a group of people who shared a love for mountaineering and a love for mountain conservation. And since then, the Alpine Club of Canada has been involved in a number of different mountain conservation, mountain science, mountain education, and mountaineering initiatives. Written into the 1906 Constitution of the Alpine Club is the mandate to promote mountain science and disseminate science to Canadians. And that is one of the objectives of the State of the Mountains report. The Alpine Club has always been involved in mountain conservation. One of our co-founders in 1907 wrote a beautiful piece about mountains and our connection to mountains and her hope that our Canadian Rockies would be preserved. And I love this quote where she says, "The Alpine Club of Canada is a national trust for the defense of our mountain solitudes against the intrusion of steam and electricity and all of the vandalisms of this luxurious utilitarian age." These activities continue today. The club now has 15,000 members from coast to coast to coast who participate in all different kinds of outdoor activities and also mountain conservation. In 2018, we decided that it was time to start a new project and start producing a State of the Mountains report for Canada that will be an annual publication. This report contains a combination of contributions from Canadian experts in various fields, people speaking about how Canadian mountain communities are adapting to change, people writing about biodiversity, about the biophysical environment, about tourism in the mountains and how livelihoods might be affected by changes occurring in the mountains. And our objective in bringing this material together is to provide it in an accessible format to all Canadians so that people can have access to that information. And our hope is that although a report each year doesn't cover maybe every single topic, over multiple years we'll end up covering a broad variety of topics. And our goal in producing this report comes back to mountain conservation. My objective and my hope is that by providing access to information about what's going on in the mountains and about the change that our mountain environments are experiencing, all Canadians will feel compelled to be promoters of mountain conservation, and that each and every one of us will go out there with a sense of stewardship for our mountains and be working to protect those special places that we all love so much. And so I'm going to pass the floor to Dave, who's going to talk about some of the highlights of the different reports.
Thanks very much, Lael. Canada's mountains are vast. They cover about a quarter of the country, 1.5 million square kilometers, something like that, seven times the area of the European Alps. They're incredibly diverse, and there's all sorts of changes and unique features of Canadian mountains. And so we can't hope to capture those in even a couple of reports. This is something we want to commit to in the longer term. But we also want to place Canada's mountains in a global context. And, you know, mountains globally, again, about a quarter of the land's earth surface is mountainous, and half a billion people call high mountains home, and half of humanity relies on water that comes down mountain rivers. There's just so many services that mountains provide. And it's only really in the last perhaps 30 years there's been a real focus on the role that mountains play, because they tend to be at the margins of societies and have relatively low populations. But starting with the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, there was a focus on sustainable mountain development. And since then, there's been a number of other activities that have really shone a light globally on mountains, and Canada increasingly has been participating in those activities also. So that's really the purpose of the State of the Mountains report. And I certainly don't want to go through everything in detail, and I wouldn't try. But I do want to highlight a few things that have been persistent in the last two reports and in our planning for the third report and into the future. And the first is our observations of the changes in Canada's glaciers and in the associated snowpack. And the bottom line is that most of them are all in a negative mass imbalance. They're all shrinking. Anyone who's been up the Icefield Parkway will have obviously seen the Peyto Glacier and Athabasca Glacier and the retreat, and our ability to document that improves over time, and it's a sad tale. And in some of the smaller glaciers in, say, Glacier in Mount Revelstoke National Park have decreased by about 10% every decade, and those rates are accelerating. And we see this throughout the mountain glaciers in Canada, and of course that's paralleled around the world. And the downstream consequences of that are tremendous. The other landscape level change, and Lael alluded to this as well with the changes in precipitation and hydrology, is an increase in mountain wildfires. These are landscape level changes. If we start to look at individual species and how they use these mountain habitats, it's quite remarkable. For example, only in the last few years have we really realized the extent to which so many species, over a third of Canada's birds, use mountain habitats for an extended period of time, either during migration or for breeding in the mountains. But 25% of those species are also at risk of some sort, either at a national or continental scale. And so our ability to understand how changes in mountain environments might influence species that use them seasonally, like migratory birds, is really something that's emerging through the content of the report. And we've also focused on little tiny organisms. And one of the stories that had the greatest media coverage last year was a story that Casey Engstrom and Lynn Quarmby at SFU wrote about the snow microbiome, snow algae. Watermelon snow, and all of the other small little fungi and bacteria and rotifers and viruses and things that live in the snow. It's amazing how poorly these are characterized. And we don't actually know how some of those species actually persist through the winter and how they come back to the surface of the snow to grow and reproduce every summer. But it's an epic migration for some of these tiny cells that are only a hundredth of a millimeter in diameter to swim up through centimeters of snow and ice to emerge back on the surface. Quite the journey. It's almost like a salmon migrating up a great river. We're learning about the biology and the physiology of these organisms. But the one thing that we see in Canadian mountains, and it's observed globally as well, is that the density of some of these snow algae is increasing. And this changes the color of the snow. It changes its albedo. And this is leading to some rapid feedbacks that lead to accelerated warming in many places as well. And snow doesn't just matter for snow algae, it matters for us as well. Winter tourism is huge in Canada. National parks, as you know, are experiencing huge numbers of visitors every year, and that's increasing over time. 19 million visits per season to ski areas across Canada, huge economic impact, large number of people employed. But the consequences of a change in the mountain environment will have a huge impact as well. So we've had a couple of stories talking about how mountain communities, mountain ski resorts might be influenced by this warming. And of course, when you get above 0 degrees winter temperature, you're not skiing anymore, you're water skiing. And so our ability to understand the rate at which that change will occur, the seasonality of those changes, and what the impacts will be on the way that people recreate in mountains or use mountains is something that we're very interested in as well. And we're trying to continue to document those perspectives in the State of Mountains report. Thank you.
Now that we have a bit of an overview of the State of the Mountains report, we're going to hear from Jim and then Dan and then Will with their own observations, either from what they've seen, personal experiences, or their own research and their responses to the report and beyond. So Jim will be next. Jim Gudjonsson is an internationally accredited mountain guide and vice president for facilities of the Alpine Club of Canada, and he's been guiding for the ACC Mountain Adventures program for more than 20 years throughout Canada and global adventures to South America, Europe, Japan, Iceland, and Greenland. Jim is known among participants for maxing out the potential of a destination and delivering life-changing experiences to all who dare to follow. In the 2019 State of the Mountains report, Jim wrote about the unique system of mountain huts that are maintained by the ACC across Western Canada.
Good evening.
I've been very fortunate to travel around the world and go places like this in Greenland as a mountain guide, and I've been involved with about 25 expeditions around the world. And for me, it's really great to hang out with these traditional hunters here and hear anecdotally how the climate is affecting them. And this is a mountain region, but obviously it's right along the ocean here as well. And so as the ice changes and as things become warmer, it affects the traditional hunters quite a bit in terms of them getting around quite a bit less. And also, as a lot of these places transition to an economy that relies somewhat on tourism, it becomes a bit more challenging for them. Back here at home, there's the Alpine Club, and this is an older picture. You can see the glacier still fairly intact, even though this looks like a late summer picture, going right up to the hut. And the glacier abutted against the rock there and protecting the permafrost and not having that many days above zero here at about 2,700 meters. Fast forward, you can see the picture on the left there. That picture is taken about 20 years ago, and you can still see the glacier there. So for 80 odd years, it was fairly intact and fairly close. And even though this is late summer, you can actually see a lot of ice there and the permafrost still intact. And then fast forward to last summer, and you can see most of the ice gone just in the last 20 years here. And what that's done has impacted the hut, and so the back corner of the hut's falling. And it's great because the Parks Canada and the Alpine Club, we all sort of stepped up and thought, well, we're going to have to save this. And the parks actually directed a lot of resources towards saving this. And so here's the team working on it last fall, just to make sure that there wasn't a catastrophic failure over the winter. And we're still not able to open it up. We weren't able to open it up this summer, but we're hoping maybe next summer if we can get in good enough shape. And you can see here how far the ice has receded there. This is a picture of one of our new huts, and I bring this picture up just to show you some of the stuff we're working on here. You can see the solar panels on the side of the hut. And so a lot of our new huts, when we think about designing them, we think about them being pretty much energy efficient, you know, from a cost-saving perspective, not flying in fuel and stuff like that. But we're really trying to be exemplars in terms of how we design our huts to be pretty efficient and sustainable over the long run. And so it's a work in progress, but I can see a day when we have a totally self-sufficient hut. We're not flying any fuel up. We're pretty much there now. Again, I think it's just important to think about as individuals and organizations how our impacts, how we move around and how we heat our homes is really what we're talking about in terms of the effects on the mountain environment, not only when we're not in those mountain environments, but just in our day-to-day lives.
Dan Sugar is an associate professor of geosciences and director of the environmental science program at the University of Calgary. Dan is a geomorphologist who's interested in rapid geologic change, primarily in high altitude and high latitude environments. And he and his students work on a variety of problems, including glacier hazards, river processes, landslides, and environmental change. In last year's State of the Mountains report, Dan wrote about, quote, river piracy and the effects of melting glaciers on mountain watersheds.
Hi, everybody. So I'm what's called a geomorphologist, which basically means that I am interested in how the surface of the Earth is changing, and that ranges from spatial scales, like an entire mountain range, all the way down to an individual grain of sand. And over time scales, it range from maybe thousands of years, so still long to most of us, but very short on geologic timescales, down to seconds or even less than a second. And so most of my research involves mountain hazards and really rapidly changing geological landscapes in the north and in the high mountains. One of the things that I quite enjoy working on are gigantic landslides. So those of you that have been down to the Frank Slide in the Crow's Nest Pass, that's the sort of event that I'm talking about here, except all of these examples are where these giant landslides have actually come down right onto glacier surfaces. And so as glaciers are eroding the valleys into which they flow, they make the valley walls quite a bit steeper than they would otherwise naturally be just from river erosion. And then as those glaciers are thawing and thinning vertically, that support of those valley walls is being reduced, and so those mountain slopes are becoming more likely to fail. And we're actually seeing that in many mountain ranges where these sorts of gigantic landslides are becoming more common as a result of glacier thinning. Another one of the glacier hazards that I have been working on the last few years are glacier lakes. And those of you that recreate in the mountains, especially in the Coast Range, but certainly to a degree in the Rockies as well, you'll know what I'm talking about. This is a photograph of a glacier supraglacial pond. So in other words, a fairly small pond on the surface of the glacier. And these, as glaciers are retreating and producing more meltwater, these are increasing in size, in both in area but also volume, but also increasing in terms of where they occur around the world. So I'm working on a study where we're mapping basically every single glacial lake in the world, and we're finding that their volume is increasing tremendously, and on the order of about 60% increase in volume over about 25 years. And I did the calculations before coming because, you know, you've got to relate everything to Olympic-sized swimming pools or something like that. And I think, if I remember correctly, it's on the order, so if you drained all of the glacial lakes in the world, it's on the order of 156,000 saddle domes that would fill. And so where that gets important is one of the big unknowns is when all these glaciers are melting, where is that water actually going? We assume it goes directly into the oceans, but the question is, well, is it? And the answer is yes, to a large degree, but a lot of it is being trapped in these lakes. And so if we took all of those lakes, 156,000 saddle domes, and we dumped them out and spread them all over the ocean basins, it would work out to less than half a millimeter of sea level change, which is not actually that much, but it's still something that we didn't know before. So that's sort of interesting from a scientific perspective, but where it gets important is that these glacial lakes pose significant threats to downstream populations. Here in North America, the threats aren't really that big because most of our towns and villages are not downstream of glacial lakes. But in places like Bhutan, in Peru, in Nepal, a lot of villages are built downstream of these glacial lakes, and sometimes on purpose because a lot of infrastructure is built there on purpose, hydropower plants, for example, to take advantage of the year-round flow from these glacial lakes. But these can burst catastrophically, easily taking out power plants and entire villages, and in fact, have on many, many occasions. So that's the kind of thing that I like to work on, and that's it for me.
And last, but certainly not least, is Will Gadd. He's an accredited mountain guide and renowned mountain athlete. A short list of his career highlights include establishing the hardest mixed ice climbing lines in the world, setting the world distance record for paragliding twice, kayaking down dozens of first ascents across North America, winning the Canadian National Sport Climbing Championships four times, winning three gold medals at the X Games, and the Ice Climbing World Cup. The United Nations has named him a mountain hero, which means that he dedicates his time to raise awareness of environmental issues, in particular the protection or environmental protection of the mountains.
I'm not an academic, I'm an ADD athlete, so completely different style of presentation here, but I'd like to talk about kind of my experience with mountains and ice and how that's changed over the years. I grew up in the Canadian Rockies here with my dad, noted conservationist and author Ben Gadd. I noticed that all the maps in the Canadian Rockies were wrong when I was a kid, and I was very disappointed by this. I'd be like, Dad, there should be a glacier there. And he'd be like, there is no glacier there. And I was like, well, it'll come back soon. So that was a kid's perspective, and that was my first sort of experience with climate change, is the maps were flat out wrong in the Rockies. The maps made in the 60s when I was using them in the 80s were often, the glaciers were like kilometers away. But I sort of thought of that as just my world, you know, it's just happening here in the Rockies, and it's not that big of a problem. We got a lot of glaciers. I was 16, pretty much nothing was going to stop me. And then as I got a little older and I became, of all things, a professional icicle climber and traveled all over the world climbing stuff like this, I started to notice some problems as I traveled globally. I'd show up in a place like Sweden and they would have this lake, and that was January, and I was there to climb ice in Sweden. And there's some issues here, eh? Like, no, the lake is not frozen. They'd be like, we had these races on this lake for 50 years straight. ever since World War II ended. We've been having motorcycle races and car races on this lake, and now you've come here to ice climb. And really sorry about that, but this lake hasn't frozen at all for the last 5 years. So it became apparent that globally there was a problem. And then it started to kind of really hit home when I went over to Africa. I was trying to climb ice on 7 different continents. So I cruised over to Africa. There's not a lot of ice in Africa, obviously. It's not well known for that. You go there to see like zebras and stuff. But on top of Kilimanjaro, there's meant to be ice. And a nice picture, there's some ice up there. And I had a map and I was pretty stoked because it showed a lot of ice. And I was like, well, cruise up there and we'll climb the ice. And I got Red Bull and Arc'teryx to give me some money, and off we went. And there was an issue. So that's the map. Like, it's all ice. We're good to go. And I did no research, eh? I was like, map, ice, we're good. ADD at its finest, you know? But show up there, yes, it's a bit of a problem. The entire glacier is kind of gone. And I expected it to be smaller, eh? Like, but it was kind of gone. And it's a high-altitude desert there now. That's what it looks like. And our story rapidly became not so much about climbing the ice and how rad that was, but just documenting these last pieces of ice up there. Like, that's all that's left. It's basically like an iceberg in a sea of sand. So I've also been working on glaciers around back to my home area here, the Athabasca Glacier, and I got interested in just going down into some of these holes in the glacier. And if you're a climber, you generally avoid these holes. They go bad places. You fall into them, you don't get seen again, or you get yanked out as a guide. It's very embarrassing. And then this researcher at the University of Alberta heard about this and was like, well, can I send my research assistant with you? I don't want to go, but we'll send her. She's disposable. This is how it works in academia. We'll send her down there and we'll check it out. And actually, Martin Sharp did end up coming. Sharp, great guy. And we got down there, and it was actually Martin Sharp who got very excited about this yellow stain on the wall. He was like, this is a biofilm. And I thought somebody just peed there, right? That's what it looked like to me. But anyhow, we got in there with Ashley and some other researchers, and they were very excited about this, and I learned how to sample. It's a weird world down there. You wear your gloves, but you sample all this stuff, and then you put it into bags, and you have to be very careful, and you send it off, and it comes back, and there's a bunch of stuff in that DNA sampling and sequencing that they found that is unusual. And glaciers are now, to me, very different. They're not hollow. They're full of holes. They're like Swiss cheese under there with all these systems, and they're full of life. And the actual biological load in the outflow from a glacier can approach that of a traditional surface river. There's a lot of stuff growing in glaciers, so they're not sterile. They're not deserts. And this was really interesting. So that's kind of what I've been involved with. I'm doing that trip back to Kilimanjaro. I'm doing another one back to Greenland. I'm trying to show climate change graphically through stories like this to people globally, and hopefully have a small impact there. And the conversation and the battle is the same one that we all face as industry or people. And I don't have all the answers. In fact, I have a few of them, but I'm going to try and work on it because it would be really cool if I could keep doing this with my kids and showing them the world and the icy world that I really, really love.
This is Blaise Kemna, and you're listening to the Canadian Mountain Podcast. You might have noticed that glaciers were discussed a lot during the panel. And as moderator Meg Wilcox once again took to the stage to read questions submitted by the audience, this was one of the first topics covered. Have a listen.
What do you think our mountains will look like in 30 years?
Well, there will be a lot fewer glaciers. Many of them will have disappeared completely. The snowpack will be less persistent in the spring. Certainly, mountains won't be as white, and there'll be consequences downstream as a result of that. We're pretty certain the ice and snow, that cryosphere, including permafrost, is going to be the first casualty in the next 30 years.
Our next question from Anonymous, where is it getting colder or where are glaciers growing marginally?
There's a few glaciers that are growing because they fall in an area, in a region that's experienced higher snowfall and still has a mean annual temperature that's sort of below zero. So zero is a critical number in all of this. 0 degrees Celsius is critical because that's where the phase change occurs between something that's frozen and solid and something that's liquid and water. So there are some glaciers at higher elevations and some in northwestern BC that are sort of anomalously, in one sense, increasing their mass balance at the higher elevations and appear to be growing in some respects. But I don't think it's something that can last in many cases.
I would say additional to that, there are certain glaciers called surge type glaciers, and these are anomalous in a different way, where they all of a sudden advance several kilometers in the course of a year or two and then waste away for several decades. And these are pretty rare, small percentage of all glaciers on Earth, and they occur regionally. So in the St. Elias Mountains is one range where they do occur. We don't have any of these kinds of glaciers in the below about 60 degrees north latitude in North America, so not in the Rockies or anything. There are also a couple of advancing glaciers in the Karakoram in Pakistan, but very few of the tens of thousands of glaciers that are on Earth are advancing.
Has there been any economic modeling, to the extent of your knowledge, on the economic impact of glacier loss, specifically of freshwater provisioning, tourism value, etc.?
Yes. I can't speak with any kind of authority there, but the short answer is yes. I mean, I don't know of any specific studies looking at the dollars or the unit of currency in whatever country, but certainly there have been quite a few studies looking at the socioeconomic impacts of melting glaciers. A lot of work happening in what's been colloquially called the third pole, the Himalaya or high mountain Asia, where something like 1 billion people rely on glacier melt. And while perhaps in the short term, the flows in the Indus River and the Brahmaputra and the Ganges may increase due to increasing glacier melt, in the longer term, sort of centennial timescales, those are certainly going, flows will certainly decrease, which of course spells disaster for hundreds of millions of people in terms of drinking water and irrigation for agriculture and hydropower as well.
Finally, questions turn towards next steps in light of all the information presented. Lael Parrott tells the audience how the State of the Mountains report has been received before Gudjonsson, Parrott, Gadd, and Hick all jump in on the last one.
We've shared the report as widely as possible with a number of provincial, municipal, local, and federal governments, generally addressing ministries of environment and parks, depending on what level we're speaking with. We've shared the report, shared its contents, and welcomed conversation. Our best conversations have been with Parks Canada because we have a good working relationship with Parks Canada already, and it's our hope that we'll eventually influence policy.
And our last question of the night, I think a good one to end on, is what can I do differently as a weekend mountain user from Calgary to reduce my carbon footprint?
So I think you can put some thought into it. Not all of us can afford to buy an electric vehicle, but we can take the most efficient vehicle. We can carpool. There's a bunch of things that we can do for sure.
We can also be mindful of our gear and how much of it we really need. Probably many of the people in the room are like me, and they're all gear. You guys are gear junkies. But there's carbon embedded in everything that we purchase as well. There's a carbon footprint of all the stuff that we have and that we use and that we own. And so thinking thoughtfully about the purchases that we make is also important, and where they come from, how they're produced, and if we really, really need them.
That does not apply to Arc'teryx gear. No, I've actually been digging into this a lot, trying to figure out where my big carbon impacts come from. And I fly a lot, so I'm buying offsets for projects that wouldn't happen otherwise. And I don't think that's a good solution. Long term, we cannot be punching holes in the atmosphere in jets. That's probably not the way forward. But some of the things I can do around the house in terms of my energy use in the house, those are actually larger than the energy I often use in my car. And where I choose to buy what I eat, and those things have big, big impacts. So for me, it's not just the recreation side of it. Like, we're eating less meat. We are doing things in our house like trying to use a lot less plastic. That's the goal in our house. And I think just being conscious of it, not just on the weekend and be like, I'll drive a little slower. I mean, that's good. Do that. But it's the whole thing.
All right. So you actually know about this.
I agree with all of the above. I mean, it's a whole lifestyle. It's not just the weekends.
Could we have a round of applause for our wonderful panelists?
In Canada, we have much to be grateful for with so many beautiful mountains. But sometimes caring for our environment can seem daunting. That's why I appreciate the panel's last answer. For as complex as sustainability and conservation can be, there are also very practical steps everyday individuals, like me, can take to properly steward my environment. That's it for this edition of the Canadian Mountain Podcast in partnership with Mount Royal University Journalism. I'm Blaise Kemna. Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to the show wherever you podcast to enjoy our latest episodes and updates. You can learn more about the Canadian Mountain Network at canadianmountainnetwork.ca.